If the Supreme Court does end up overturning Roe v. Wade, as last week's leaked draft opinion would suggest it is about to do, it would be considered a huge victory for religious conservatives who've been pushing for such an outcome for decades, and also for political conservatives who have relied on the religious right as the fuel for their broader movement. That suggests that opposition to abortion rights is the overwhelming priority for religious conservatives, and that it's always been that way. But we wondered if that's really true, and if so, why? And that led us to Kristen Cobus-Dumais. She's been thinking about, researching, and writing about these issues for years in her work as a professor of history and gender studies at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She also identifies as an evangelical Christian. She says that it wasn't until the late 1970s that abortion became a mobilizing force for the religious right. Before that, she told us, there was actually a diversity of opinion about abortion in evangelical spaces.
In the late 1960s, we have this remarkable issue of Christianity Today, the flagship magazine of American evangelicalism, discussing this question of abortion. And the conclusion is that it's a very complicated moral issue. So there are theologians discussing precisely when ensoulment happens. When does the fetus become an actual life? And weighing the complicated issues, not just in terms of rape and incest, but also the health and well-being of the mother and the family. And yes, the Southern Baptist Convention comes out in favor of opening up access to abortion in many cases in 1971, and then they reaffirm that in 1974 and in 1976, so after Roe v. Wade. But what happens in the 1970s is, first of all, with the passing of Roe v. Wade, you see a spike in the number of abortions. And that causes many Americans, not just evangelicals, to kind of rethink, is this what we wanted? But I think more importantly, you have the rise of second-wave feminism and in conservative white evangelical spaces, a real backlash against feminism. And over the course of that decade, abortion becomes linked to feminism. And so you see the sentiment start to shift so that in 1979, when political activist Paul Weyrich identifies abortion as a potential to really mobilize conservative evangelicals politically to help build the moral majority, then it is a very effective mechanism for doing so. And from 1979 on, that's when you see a real kind of shrinking of space within conservative evangelicalism to have any view on abortion that isn't strictly and staunchly pro-life. Life begins at conception.
I'm still so interested in why, and this is not to argue the point, but it is to ask why this over other issues, that this country's the lack of access to routine health care, for example, particularly compared to that of peer nations, that's been a fact of life for years, and that has resulted in some terrible outcomes. I mean, I don't think it's a secret. I mean, there have been prominent evangelical leaders like, I'm thinking about Harry Banks, for example, who wrote about how he was nearly bankrupted by his battle with cancer.
Yes.
Or people whose lack of access to prenatal care has led to shocking maternal mortality rates in this country,
yes,
particularly among Black and brown women and Indigenous women, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering why these issues have never surfaced to the same degree. I mean, one would think that if you adopt a perspective that values and reveres the sanctity of life, then it would be across the life spectrum.
Yes.
I mean, that doesn't even address issues like the death penalty or something. That's like a whole separate issue. But just the question of keeping women alive during and after childbirth would seem to be something that would have equal weight, but it doesn't. And I just wondered if you have a theory about why that is.
You're right. It does not. Now, there is a minority of evangelicals, of white evangelicals, who do embrace this holistic life commitment, including the death penalty and pro-gun legislation and pro-healthcare, universal healthcare, but that is a definite minority. Among many white evangelicals, their moral system is one that really embraces an individualistic ethos or ethic, really. And so we are all to kind of fend for ourselves. And it is one that pushes back against systemic issues or a systemic way of understanding inequality, understanding things like racism or access to healthcare. And so abortion is an issue that fits well with this individualistic framework in the way that they approach it. And so they will say, this is, this is a life of a human being. And it's just a clear-cut case, and it is an innocent life. And so in cases like the death penalty, or even in sometimes this is extended to discussions of healthcare. Well, if you had been more responsible, if you had a higher income, if you, there are things you could have done here. Whereas abortion, it seems very simple or even simplistic. But I should also add that abortion, we need to understand how abortion is also situated in terms of evangelical gender ideals. And for evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, gender difference is really foundational to their understanding of the social order. And they believe that God created men and women to be very different, even opposites. And women's primary calling is that of wife and mother. And so abortion also really severs that kind of biological or social relationship, or threatens to do so. And for that reason also, abortion is such a priority for evangelicals, because it kind of strikes at the heart of their understanding of women and men and their understanding of how God has ordered society.
So that leads to my next question about, I think many people remain puzzled by evangelical support for former President Trump. I mean, many people saw it as extremely odd that conservative Christians would align with a candidate who would seem to have violated their principles and values in so many ways. Many people say that it all comes down to the Supreme Court picks and overturning Roe, that it was basically transactional, that he promised to appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe. And so that was the basis of that. Do you buy that?
Well, I think that that thesis really ignores the grassroots support for Trump among white evangelicals early in the primary season. As early as August of 2015, we can see the support for Donald Trump emerging among the white evangelical base. And so Trump would not have secured the nomination had it not been for this support among white evangelicals. But also, if we look at the election of Trump and then early into his presidency and really throughout his presidency, we don't see a lot of evidence that suggests that white evangelicals were really holding their noses to vote for Trump, despite the fact that he didn't really appear to model this morality that they had long championed, the moral majority. And he certainly wasn't the poster boy for family values, but he did promise to fight for them. He promised to advance their cause, and that's why many voted for him. And they certainly were very happy when they saw the Supreme Court choices. Now, you could suggest that any Republican candidate would have, potential candidate would have also appointed similar justices to the court. But what I did see in the wake of the leak of this preliminary document, as I saw a lot of not just celebration across the evangelical world on this potential decision, but I also saw a lot of these pro-Trump evangelicals really kind of sticking it to the never-Trump evangelicals, saying, see, not just we were right, but really shaming anybody who didn't vote for Trump out of these concerns about his morality or his authoritarian tendencies, and saying, see, we were right, the ends justifies the means.
That was Kristen Cobus-Dume, professor of history and gender studies at Calvin University. Her latest book is called Jesus and John Wayne. Professor Dume, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this expertise with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And if you'd like to hear more of my conversation with Kristen Cobus-Dume, you can download NPR's Consider This podcast.